proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses.
I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm speaking with Josh Busby, Associate Professor at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin, about his work with mapping hotspots of climate security vulnerability. Josh, first, can you describe your current projects on climate security for the Department of Defense and give some background on some of the similar work you've done in the past?
We're completing a second project for the Department of Defense on complex emergencies and political stability in Asia, and that's building on a previous project we did on climate change and African political stability. Both of those projects, we've tried to map hotspots of what we call climate security vulnerability, the locations where we think the worst consequences of climate change may come to pass. That would be including but not limited to conflict, so things like mortality associated with climate-related hazards like cyclones, droughts, sea level rise, wildfires, and floods. And so we've done a series of vulnerability maps at the subnational level to isolate these hotspots, both for Africa and 11 countries in South and Southeast Asia.
Give me a sense of the audiences for this kind of vulnerability and hotspot mapping.
I think there are diverse audiences interested in the work, including folks in the Pentagon, obviously, who've supported it, but people in the aid community, national governments themselves are going to be interested in, you know, thinking about where these hotspots are, although, you know, many countries obviously have more detailed knowledge at the subnational level already. But NGOs, researchers in the field, there are myriad audiences for this kind of work. The real question that we have to ask and answer all the time is, do the maps do they have any basis in reality? Are they useful? Do they help serve a purpose in guiding planners, donors, national governments, those who are trying to work to shore up resilience on the ground? Do they help them do their jobs better?
How can you tell if your mapping mirrors the reality on the ground?
You know, one of the things that we've done throughout our work is tried to do some ground truthing by taking the maps to the region and meeting with local folks to get a sense of, is this an adequate representation of local reality? So, you know, one of the things that we found in our first iteration of maps on East Africa is that local folks said we weren't capturing some of the challenges associated with chronic water scarcity, say in the pasture lands and the pastoral areas in the northeastern Kenya and other places. And so, you know, one of the things that we did right away is tried to figure out new indicators to incorporate into the maps to make them more representative of the features and realities that they live with every day. So that's one example. But more of the iterative process of the making of the maps to make them better portraits of reality. One of the more practical examples of sorts of the kinds of policy relevant dialogues that have been set in motion by our maps is we did an overlay of World Bank and African Development Bank projects on our vulnerability maps for Africa and East Africa in particular. And one of the things that came out of our mapping work is that Somalia, came across as the most vulnerable country and at the subnational level on the entire continent of Africa. Yet there were hardly any projects there in the period of the late, 2009-2010 era. And that mostly, if we think about the challenges of governance in the region, it's been very difficult for aid and development projects to work there. And so it raises interesting questions about what should the priorities of the donor community be? Should you try and spend more money in the most vulnerable places? Or given the governance challenges, is it right that they spent their money in the places where they could, like Tanzania and Kenya? One journalist described some of the challenges associated with climate vulnerability as a kind of reverse beauty contest, in which there may be some competition for countries to represent themselves as the most vulnerable, to the extent that there might be more expectations for assistance from the international community if countries can make a credible case that they are likely to suffer adverse harm from climate change. And so this makes this exercise of vulnerability mapping potentially quite fraught, and there are very significant resource implications of mapping work that shows patterns of vulnerability, that if people use those maps in turn to make decisions about investments. And so, what we have to do is be aware that there are significant resource implications associated with work like ours. And so we have to be very confident that the kind of work that we're doing is robust and give some people some guidelines about how it should be used. Because one of the challenges is it's very difficult to validate that what you're capturing in the maps is representative of real world phenomenon. And so you have to be modest in what you think the maps can tell policymakers, but also realize that there is some seductive power in the way maps simplify complex reality. So, no matter what kinds of guidance you give others about how best to use your material, people may not always use it in that way. So you want to be as confident as you can as what you're representing. It tells some truth and some useful truth.
In communicating the importance of your work to stakeholders, to funders, and policymakers, how do you maintain both the legacy and the future of your work and research, especially if politics change or there are shifts in new research or shifts in the kinds of things that we know in terms of your mapping work?
I've done some work on climate messaging, and one of the core challenges we face in the United States is building a wide enough political constituency for action on this problem. And in some of my messaging work, experimental methods, we actually successfully demobilized people. We made people less likely to take these concerns seriously. And but more recent work has found that from the Yale Climate Communications Group that there's broad agreement on some of the solutions on the mitigation side to climate change, and yet they're often things like renewable energy and other policies, maybe putting a price on pollution, that aren't justified in climate terms, that they're very attractive policies on their own in terms of providing jobs and new sources of innovation. And so, talking about the problem and trying to win over people through the lens of climate change is actually less successful than just talking about solutions. And that's a really attractive way to think about this problem. Now, it may also be true on the adaptation and resilience front that talking about water and security may be more attractive in this political environment than talking about climate and security. And that's something that we also have to be mindful of, building a constituency that comes to these problems not necessarily through the lens of climate change, but through the lens of related problems that are affected by climate change. And water is a great example of that. Water is essential for life. It is used for diverse purposes, not just to sate our thirst, but to irrigate our crops and feed us. It's important in industry and electricity. And so because of water centrality to human well-being, I think it creates a reservoir of political goodwill that goes across political ideologies. And that's why we've had great success in the U.S. government in creating a groundswell of sustained support for water and sanitation funding with the Paul Simon Water for the World Act in 2014, which built upon previous legislation. So we've been able to create very large sources of funding, but it's been primarily for water and sanitation, so taps and toilets. And what's been lost in this wider discussion is concerns about water and security and the institutions, both at the national level and the international level, that can shore up the ability of countries and regions to manage water resources on their own. And so I think that this ties back to the backdraft potential in that, you know, we have approached the problem of water from a kind of technical humanitarian ethos, which is good, but we've sort of shielded ourselves from the wider issues associated with management of water resources. And having done that, you know, it raises questions about the sustainability of the exercise of continuing to fund that sort of technical outlets of taps and toilets. Because if countries ultimately don't succeed in being able to manage their water resources both internally and with their neighbors, then the improvements we've seen in the health and sanitation arena could come undone at some point. And I think that's really what folks who are approaching this from this both sensitivity to the backdraft, but also to the security landscape have come to, that the taps and toilets agenda can only take us so far.
You mentioned this wider discussion of water and security and those institutions that can shore up a country's ability to manage water resources. So how do you see examples such as the Mekong River Commission playing out, especially in terms of unintended consequences, this idea of backdraft, and then, you know, the gaps between responses to climate change at the national and international institutional levels?
In recent years, last year, for example, Vietnam faced one of the most severe droughts in its history. And in some of the challenges associated with the Mekong have led other countries in the region, Laos and Thailand, to build dams upstream, which has affected the flows of water for downstream users like Vietnam. So that not only affects agricultural uses, but also massive fisheries industry. And so the Mekong becomes a site of constant contestation over water, and countries in the region are approaching this problem by large infrastructure problems projects to satisfy their own water needs, which then makes their neighbors insecure. The Mekong River Commission has been the main institutional body that's been developed to manage these tensions between users along the Mekong, but doesn't include all of the countries that are part of the river basin. Namely, China is an upstream country that isn't part of the MRC, and yet has built dams and supported dam building throughout the region in ways that are having a major impact on downstream users. So the lesson from this is that, you know, institutions that are meant to deal with transboundary water issues need to include all the relevant stakeholders. One of the challenges we've also seen with respect to the Mekong River Commission is that it's been housed in Laos, and Laos itself has not been responsible in its own water management and has built a number of dams and water diversion projects that have then unsettled its neighbors. And as a consequence of that, the MRC has lost the confidence of international donors who've restricted levels of funding in recent years. So it's a challenging one to think about in terms of what are the implications for the international community when you want to approach institution building. One is you have institutions that don't include all the relevant stakeholders, but then you also have flaws in existing institutions that aren't living up to their mandate. So how do you think about institutional reform and giving the incentives for change when they themselves might not have the internal wherewithal to carry on without foreign funding?
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.